welcome to the 87th episode of Reverse Rem Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Timmy Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that has already abandoned its New Year's resolutions.
Yep, you heard that correctly. We have resolved to do absolutely nothing different in 2017, but just more of the same that has served us so well in the past. We believe that there is at least one person who listens to us occasionally out there, so why would we change anything? It has, of course, been the silly season. Hope you've all had a good one. And we've got all kinds of silliness to come in the podcast. We're going to be looking back at what's happened over the last few weeks and what's caught our eye on the international and local scene. Andy's going to be giving us a really fascinating insight into something that I've always wanted to know more about, which is that infamous ball, the Googly. And we're going to be reviewing Supreme Bowling 100 Great Test Performances. So, Andy, what's caught your eye over the Christmas season in the cricketing world?
Well, I previously used to be very good at looking around the internet for sort of good new cricket writing. And then, frankly, I got pretty lazy, and now, like probably the vast majority of cricket fans, I just head to Crick Info. And that's why we need people like Chris Smith of the Declaration blog, who's a previous guest on this podcast and a good friend of the show, who has undertaken to create and does this every year. He's created a select 11 of cricket blog posts from 2016. It's a real testament to his efforts, you know, looking around and making sure that these great writers get the attention they deserve. I won't attempt to paraphrase all the pieces in the selection because you should go and check it out for yourselves. But what I would say, that both the variety and quality are superb. And there's a lot of cricket writing that's not, it's not cricket writing as we would normally see it. It's kind of life and then cricket kind of intervenes at some point. So yeah, well worth checking it out.
It's one of the things that we're really lucky with in the game, I think, that not only do we have a kind of really huge corpus of established cricket literature, and obviously we review books on a regular basis, but out there in that great, wild, wonderful jungle that is the blogosphere and the internet, there are just thousands of people who are writing interesting things about all kinds of weird and wonderful things. I was reading a blog earlier today, which is entitled A Constraint-Led Approach to Coaching Cricket, which is by a guy who I think is the dad of Peter Hanscom, the guy who just made his debut for Australia. But there is this fascinating world, and good on Chris for having kind of brought it out, because it is sometimes quite bewildering. There is just so much out there, you just don't really know where to start. That's something that I'm going to be heading over and having a look at. You need to post that link on Twitter, actually, so that we can all have a look.
No, I will do, and I think you're exactly right. It's the story of the internet that there's obviously so much out there, and you need some people to do the hard work in really getting the good stuff and put it and making it accessible. Now, you have been at the forefront. Well, not at the forefront. You've been pitch side for Australia's revival.
Yes, sort of. So actually, I mean, it's something that I have very mixed feelings about. So I moved to, in 12 days' time, I'll be celebrating my third anniversary of living in Australia. And one thing that I've never quite been able to get around to is rooting for Australia in the cricket. And so I was actually quite surprised at my reaction to the fortune of the Australian team over the last little while. So obviously Australia went to Sri Lanka, lost heavily away there. They then had a series that was nothing short of calamitous against South Africa here in Australia. And suddenly there was this real sense of an Australian team having a real crisis. And certainly in the country here, Australians get very het up. The length and breadth of the land when their national team isn't performing well, it's a real stain on the reputation of Australia. And so actually to watch the turnaround of Australia against a Pakistani side, which, you know, absolutely has been number one in the world recently, but possibly isn't the greatest side of all time. But nevertheless, the turnaround that this Australian team has had has been absolutely astonishing. And actually, there hasn't been that much change. Okay, fine, they sacked the chairman of the selector, stepped down, and there have been one or two changes in the team. But it seems to go something beyond that. There seems to be suddenly something snapped and a real resolve came to the team. And I reckon that Steve Smith probably can take a lot of kind of compliment to that. There are still some real problems. Matthew Wade as keeper isn't probably a long-term solution. Nathan Lyon, it'll be interesting to see how he goes as the main spinner on the subcontinent. But the thing that's actually quite refreshing is seeing the return of an Australian team that can win even when they're not performing at their very best. The way that they just absolutely dispatched Pakistan 3-0, and I was lucky enough to see some of the game at the SCG, the way that they absolutely dispatched Pakistan was actually really really impressive, even, as I say, without playing at 100% strength. And actually kind of reminds you really of those great teams, Australian teams of the late 90s and early 2000s in that ruthless ability.
You see, I think it's interesting to hear you talking about what a crisis it felt like in Australia, because even from here, there was a real sense of Australia thinking like, God, our game really needs a reinvention. And I think what the Australians must find incredibly encouraging is that for all the talk there's been in recent years of, oh dear, the production line seems to be running dry, they've turned to a couple of young batsmen who've instantly stepped up, you know, Renshaw in particular, you know, they really seem to have stepped up. I must admit that for me, the main takeaway from this series hasn't been so much the Australia revival, as just so sad to see the way Pakistan in the end basically rolled over.
It was just appalling whenever there was any degree of pressure that was, yeah, that was put. They just absolutely capitulated. You know, Misbah is a miserable side out there in the middle at the moment. Mm. And, you know, it's just, I mean, the Yunus Khan, I saw Yunus Khan back quite a lot, actually. He got a big century at the SCG, and that was kind of refreshing. But there was a real sense of despondency about the Pakistani team, which, yeah, was very sad. But you've actually managed to watch not only a bit of Test cricket, I think, but also other forms of the Australian game over Christmas.
Well, I was really surprised, probably like quite a lot of British cricket fans, I was very surprised to discover the Big Bash League over Boxing Day breakfast on Channel 5. So Channel 5, for those of you non-UK listeners, is one of five terrestrial free-to-air channels in the UK. And there's been endless controversy in the UK over the lack of accessibility to cricket on free-to-air. You can only watch it on paid-for satellite TV. And Channel 5 have changed this. It was quite interesting to see, because obviously I've heard you talk about it, and I've heard the Big Bash has been such a success as a phenomenon. Wasn't a great game, a bit one-sided, but the main thing I found myself thinking was how extraordinary that we've got to the stage that I can watch Stuart Broad representing the Hobart Hurricanes on UK free-to-air TV, and yet I can't at any point this summer watch an English County game there. And I think it's a sad indictment. I mean, credit to Channel 5 for showing some entrepreneurialism, and I think they're doing well with it, because they're getting some games that are like breakfast time, and it's working for people. I think there's one this morning, actually. But it's a damning indictment of what we've done in England, where we're relying on sort of international competitions, where we can't even watch our domestic game at home.
I was reflecting on kind of a similar point today when I was actually cycling back from a cricket game that I was playing in earlier today, 28 off 29 balls, since you ask. I cycled past a bus shelter, and in it they had, you know, a series of bus shelters, actually, and in it they had these massive Big Bash League and Women's Big Bash League equal billing, the men's and the willing side by side, massive bus stop campaign in down in South Sydney. And actually the ability to really spread the game about in a really significant way beyond the traditional audience has been really actually achieved really impressively by the Big Bash. And it's just, yeah, as you say, it really does highlight how bad we are doing that in the UK as well.
And you've been thinking beyond that more generally on what the success of T20 means for Test cricket now in 2017?
Yeah, so I was struck by an article, actually, which highlighted the fact that in 2017, the Australia schedule, so obviously, I'll start again, the ICC schedules the entirety of cricket, international cricket, across the board around the year. So there's one body that looks after all of it. It's not one body that looks after tests and separate body that looks after T20. So you'd think the scheduling was quite coherent. But what this article was pointing out is that in the case of Australia, for instance, and apparently there are instances with other teams, there's absolutely no consideration given for how the 2020 and the test games are going to sit side by side. So, for instance, Australia are due to play a 2020 in Adelaide against Sri Lanka on the 22nd of February. And then they start their test war of India with a game in India the very next day. And so basically what the schedulers have been saying is either they should completely compromise their preparations for the test tour just pick their best 11 for the 2020 match and then just start the test tour a bit later and people fly over whenever they can be bothered. Or they should have two sides, and they should have a test side and they should have a 2020 side, and essentially the two aren't going to mix. And what's happened is that Australia have actually come out And Steve Smith, the captain, for one, has said that he will not play in those 2020s because he wants to be in India preparing for that test, or because he sees the test, you know, test cricket as being the pinnacle. And in a way, that's great. It's great that Steve Smith has come out and said the test, you know, is the most important thing there. But it seems absolutely bizarre that this decision should have to be made. I mean, there's, you know, years are a long time, and there's a lot of time in which to play cricket. We do not need to be jamming these things up, one against the other. And it seems to be absolutely, you know, to no benefit to either form of the game.
What's particularly extraordinary is that an Australia tour of India is, you know, Ashes aside, is kind of as big as it gets for Australia. You know, it's a huge challenge, this whole, you know, the final frontier to win in India. So the idea that you'd schedule games at that notice and make that preparation worse, I guess, as you made the point, part of this will to a degree be manageable by different sides. I mean, you look at the way, for example, England's very successful, if not quite World Cup winning T20 team. You've got to a stage where there's a couple of players, sort of core players, who do the Roots and Stokes of this world, who do play in both sides. But we do now increasingly, and I think we're probably pretty common on this, have quite a few players, both bowlers and batsmen, who do only turn up for the T20s.
From the archives, and this episode, Andy is going to take us back to the origin of one of the most iconic balls in cricket, the googly.
So put simply, a googly is just an off-break bowled with an apparent leg-break action, but that really doesn't do it justice. If you've never tried to bowl one, I strongly suggest you give it a go, because without trying, you just cannot appreciate what an awkward, tricky action it is. So with a normal leg-break, the ball faces towards the batsman, and as a bowler, you are moving the ball away from a right-handed batsman. With a googly, the ball comes out the back of the hand, and with the seam angled towards fine leg, it's moving in towards a right-handed batsman. Try this, and it's hard enough, I think, just getting the ball out of your hand. The idea that you can do this and land the ball where you want, I think, is deeply impressive. It's always difficult in cricket when you talk about the inventor of anything, whether it's a shot or whether it's a delivery. But in the case of the googly, there is general recognition that Bernard Bosanquet was its inventor. He credits its invention from his time playing an excellent sounding game called Twisty Twosty. Now,
Have been brilliant cricketer if I played more Twisty Twosty, I reckon.
Well, it's an excellent.
It also sounds like a bad crisp or something that you get in a service station and would have bucket loads of MSG on it. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, go on.
Bucket loads of salt and vinegar Twisty Twosties. Yeah, I can see that. The aim of Twisty Twosty is to bounce a tennis ball on a table in such a way that your opponent, who's sitting opposite, couldn't catch it. So I guess I was trying to visualise this. It's a kind of, I guess, maybe a sort of table tennis setup, you know, you're trying to just get it past the other player. And Bosanquet obviously took this game rather seriously and found that a googly action was the way to win, which you can imagine if your opponent sees your wrist go one way and the ball goes the other. This is a great wheeze.
And that's brilliant, because actually I've always been fascinated by those descriptions of... We read a book recently which is all about Australian cricketers and how they were shaped by the environments in which they grew up. And one of the really frequent things that you get from both bowlers and batsmen is how you come to take advantage of your surroundings if you're playing on a cobbled street or something like that. But it's always that the surroundings brings the advantage, as it were. But what's great about Bosanquet's, you know, innovation here is that he actually kind of turned the entire thing on his head, because obviously a flat table has absolutely no deviant possibilities, as it were, in and of itself at all. So this is actually quite a kind of... It would have taken quite a mind to come up with something like that, particularly, as you say, something that has such an awkward action to it, to decide to do that.
I think the other thing that maps across very well from what you're talking about backyard cricket is that this was innovation through playing. You can't always, in the context of a high-pressure cricket game, it's quite hard to innovate. It's quite hard to try a new shot or try a new ball when, you know, the pressure is what it is. But actually playing a casual game of Twisty Twosty, you know, you can innovate to your heart's content. And Bosanquet took this idea and started trying to apply it to cricket bowling. He says rather wonderfully that it was motivated partly by the desire to avoid having to bowl fast on hot afternoons. And I really like this explanation because it fits with what a lot of the great tech entrepreneurs say about how great ideas are often driven by laziness. Great inventors often think, I can't be bothered to do this the hard way. There must be an easy way.
Okay, so I feel a bit cheated that the ball is not now called the Twisty Twosty. At what point did it kind of lose the Twisty Twosty name and suddenly become the Googly, which is a great name, but possibly not quite as good as Twisty Twosty?
Well, one of the oddest things I found while researching this feature is that there isn't actually an agreed answer for where the word Googly came from. So one theory that's been put forward is that, so in Australia, the Googly was also at one stage used to refer to just a high looping ball that confused the batsman, making him all goggle-eyed. Tom Horan, who is an Irish-born Australian batsman and also something of a cricket writer, came up with a very, I think, frankly, excessive and not quite believable explanation that goo was a baby-like sound, guile was what the delivery contained, and therefore googly was a conjunction of the two. Not quite convinced by that.
Because the batsman was kind of making a baby-like sound and the bowler was using guile.
Yes,
sounds like one of the worst logical descriptions I've ever come across, but yeah, okay.
It feels like a stretch. And finally, David Frith, the very well-respected cricket writer, has suggested that it might be of Maori origin after Lord Hawke's tour of New Zealand in 1902-1903, which is all a very long way of saying that we don't know. But what we do know is that by the time Bosanquet was bowling it, googly, certainly within the UK, was what it was universally referred to as. Now, Amal Rajan makes the case in The Twirly Men, his excellent study of spin that we previously reviewed on the podcast, that Bosanquet had a certain braggadocio, or at least self-assurance, common to all great inventors. And I think this is a great observation because as he needed to have a lot of self-confidence to experiment with this delivery that is always at times going to go wrong and leave him open to ridicule. But he also needed this to survive the very heavy criticism that the googly was met with. This is a common story that we come across again and again on this podcast, in which a cricket innovation is greeted as immoral. We seem to have this weird pattern in cricket, and maybe it applies across lots of other areas of life, that when something is new and the instinctive reaction is a conservative one, everyone is like, oh God, this awful thing ruining our traditional sport. This is probably best summarised by a quote from England's captain at the time, Archie MacLaren, who said of the googly, "If this sort of bowling becomes general, I'm packing my bag for good and aye, and what's more, goodbye to all style and attractiveness in batting." Very few grey areas there.
So, and is that because he found it too difficult to bat against? Because I know that, for instance, I mean, this is, and I'm kind of talking a little bit off the cuff here, but so the flipper, which is the kind of, you know, the one that's halfway between the ordinary leg break and the googly, it's the one that basically goes straight on but bounces a bit more, but bowled with the same action, just side on, which was invented or is credited as being having invented by Clary Grimmett. When he first bowled that, there was an interesting similar reaction whereby batsmen all over the place just said, this is just unfair now. You know, if bowlers can bowl balls like this, that's it. We don't know how we're actually going to play them anymore. What's wrong with, you know, good old-fashioned fastball, you know, bounce them at our heads? We'll take that. That's manly, but none of this kind of devious underhand stuff. And it seems from MacLaren's reaction as if that was kind of the same sentiment in a way as well.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think what's most extraordinary is there were stories of great batsmen at the time who, because of this feeling that the googly was immoral, just insisted on playing them like leg breaks, even if that meant getting out, because they felt that to adapt to it would almost be to sort of, you know, be complicit
lower
in this immoral game. Now, Bosanquet was well aware of this criticism. He couldn't help but be. And he felt moved to defend it in an article in the Morning Post called The Scapegoat of Cricket, which is well worth the read, and I'll link to it on the website. But it's kind of extraordinary that it got to the stage where he was actually having to write articles defending what he'd done. His life story merits a feature of his own, but what I will say is he did have success with the googly. His career was sort of very up and down, but he did have success with the googly. A particular highlight dismissing a certain Victor Trumper, which led the great Australian to smile, shake his head, and said the eternal line, "That was too good for me, son." Now, Don Bradman had strong views on the googly, and he made the point that actually it wasn't so much, in his view, about tricking the batsman with the direction. He said that actually, obviously, you get to a stage in your career as a batsman like Bradman that you could read the wrist and you could see what was going. He thought the key thing was in the change of pace, so that a googly came across slightly slower than a leg break, which increases the risk of close catches because the batsman goes forward a little too soon and is in danger of spooning up a catch. So I think it's important to appreciate that there's other subtleties going on with the googly. It's never just been about trying to trick with turn. Now, if we think of, I guess, without doubt, the greatest leg spinner of our lifetime, and judged by many to be the greatest of all time, Shane Warne, he actually employed the googly very rarely. A large part of this is the fact that it was the only delivery that Warne bowled which caused his fingers to blister. So he actually had, as a leg spinner, well, as any spinner, your fingers are vital. So you had no choice but to kind of look after them, and as a result, he couldn't use it often. It's been used as something to criticise Warne. So some have made the case that actually, how can you be a truly great leg spinner without a truly great googly? Gideon Hay, however, has rushed to refute this and has made the case that actually his aversion to the googly was a little statement of his own, that Warne had charge of his bowling rather than the other way round. And I think this is a great point about the potential danger of the googly. And I think you particularly see this in club cricket, where the leg spinner gets so excited that they can bowl one that you suddenly see them bowling it again and again and again. And there is definitely a lesson here that it is sort of a tool and a weapon to be employed in your armory, but you have to do so selectively because the odd thing about the googly is the moment you start overusing it, the magic kind of goes. It just becomes another delivery that the batsman can read. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading Supreme Bowling 100 Great Test Performances, compiled and edited by Patrick Faraday and Dave Wilson. This book attempts to identify and depict the 100 greatest bowling performances of cricket test history. Toby, what do you make of the method used to identify those performances?
Well, I think first of all, I should say that this is usually the kind of book that I, run a million miles from and then pour scorn on when we have to review them. And it was actually a very pleasant surprise reading it. Basically, the book is divided up into two halves, or there's the first half is a lot smaller than the second half. But the first half is talking about exactly this method for how you would go about ranking one bowling performance against another, and then the second half of the book goes through talking about in detail each one of those 100 bowling performances. In the way that the and I'm not going to be exhaustive in any way at this point because it is an incredibly kind of painstaking method that has been come up with here. But basically, it takes into account everything from the situation in the match through to where the player was at in their career, through to what the pitch was like, through to what the other bowlers were doing. All kinds of things come into play in considering the relative value of each of these bowlers. For me, or each of these bowling performances, for me, the real interest of the book lay in the second half and just this amazing wealth of chapters that are written about individual innings. But just going back to the something a bit more about the methodology. I mean, for me, I kind of read it and thought, "Oh, that's all very interesting," and then completely separately read the second half of the book. Did you see a real synergy between the two? Did you suddenly think, "Oh, that's the methodology, and now I can see why they're saying this good innings in the second half?"
Well, I think you're instinctively skeptical of any attempt to rank cricketing performances objectively. You just think it can't be done. And yet, what I found so impressive here is that cricket is always a game of stats. We always throw stats around very nonchalantly, but actually, it's relatively rare to read cricket writing that attempts true analysis where varying stats are combined to get to a better understanding of performances. And I think you are absolutely right in that this is an incredibly comprehensive methodology. I mean, they include so many variables. I mean, Faraday's sort of honest at one stage that you do get to a stage where you finally have to stop because there are just too many imponderables. I also think he's very innovative at times. There's some very clever stuff, I think, particularly around rating performances on rarity. So, you know, looking at the number of times, for example, 8 wickets has been taken in a test and using that to rate it. There's also, they attempt to do the qualitative as well as the quantitative, and a wonderful example of how difficult that is in trying to assess conditions and what role they played. And a very quick anecdote here, they look at the performance of Chandrasekhar at the Oval in 1971, where he took 6 for 38. And at different points, different journalists said the surface suited him, offered little assistance, responded to hit spin, and offered little help to spinners, which gives you an idea of what a sort of chaotic undertaking it is to sort of actually come to an objective view of something like the conditions.
One of the things that I think would have been really fascinating to have had actually would be a, because you know they are very, as you said, they're very exhaustive in going through and coming up with what the kind of parameters are. But then when we actually get to the individual bowling performances, we don't actually know how those have been applied. So actually how a particular innings has scored in terms of the difficulty of the pitch or, you know, any other aspect, which seemed to me a little bit of an omission. And I think could have been, I mean, it would have made the book double the length almost. But it would have been really, really, and that's probably why it's not there, but would have been a really, really fascinating. And even if there are things that might have been done differently, the fact that they built this whole thing is just so impressive and thought-provoking in and of itself.
And it's a wonderful opportunity to unleash a lot of fantastic authors on giving these performances the credit they deserve. And I think one thing that works brilliantly is each of these authors, I guess, has a kind of a single format to work to. You know, it's describe the bowling performance in the context of the game, give a little bit of background on the bowler. And yet, all these authors do so in a very kind of independent way. And I particularly enjoyed James Metier, who's a new name to me, gave a very personal account of Willis's contribution to the miracle of Headingley in 81, and actually takes a lot of time to set the performance in the context of Britain at the time. And I think it's one of the pleasures, it's really the pleasure of an anthology, isn't it? You know, if one, if you'd given this book to one great cricket author, I'm sure it would have been fun. But actually, having lots of different authors applying their sort of own style to the task is really enjoyable. Which were the most memorable bits for you from the descriptions of performances?
One of the things that really struck me actually was the performance that came in at number one. Is that a game that you were familiar with before reading this book?
No, so I had to be honest, I had heard of Tayfield. But I absolutely was not familiar with the game, and absolutely was not familiar with his own sort of long-term success.
So this is Hugh Tayfield, who takes 9 for 113 off 37 overs with 11 maidens against England in Johannesburg in February 1957, which is the greatest bowling performance of all time. And there is something marvelously democratic about this book as well, I find, in a way that it just gets, because we all have these debates in the pubs all the time. What was the greatest innings of, you know, and it's all based on what is our memory, what do we know? So, you know, we weren't watching Test cricket in 1957. And also, you know, what do we, you know, there are certain innings or bowling
Well,
performances that hold much more resonance with you.
yeah.
But there is something gloriously democratic. This is what I loved about reading through this. You know, the fact that, you know, you then have Harbhajan Singh at 2 and Stuart Broad at 3. And it absolutely, by going back to the statistics, it has that brilliant combination of going back to the statistics to come up with the order and then going, as you say, to all these brilliant cricket writers to again give it all the colour and motion and life that good writing can give it as well.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point around the idea that these performances and these descriptions tap into your own memory or not. So there are some of these performances that you'll never heard of that you're introduced to. But then there are some of the others where I found myself, it's astonishing reading about Ishant Sharma's 7 for 74 at Lord's, which I'd watched on TV. And I remember the consensus of the commentators at the time that this was a complete nonsense from England. No one gave Sharma any credit at at all. And Faraday, who actually writes that description, builds a very convincing wicket-by-wicket case for Sharma and the fact that, we, you know, he does deserve credit for the performance. And it's very interesting, both reassessing your own conceptions of these games. And as you said, democratic. I mean, the wonderful things that stats do is that you have some bowlers very near the top of this list who, in the context of their wider careers, were not great. But they do have, and what's wonderful is they are immortalised through great performances. And, you know, in a structure like this, those bowlers stand alongside, you know, maybe their more established peers.
Von Crumb Publishing have a website, which I believe you can buy it through, and it certainly comes with our hearty recommendation. It's one of those ones that you kind of keep and dip into time and time again, I think. So that was the 87th episode, would you believe it, of Reverse Swept Radio. Thank you for joining us as ever, if you've got this far through the podcast. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. By that point, I will actually have been live to my first ever Big Bash game, so we'll be able to see what all the fuss is about there. But if that doesn't appeal to you, then tune in anyway to hear all of the usual witty repartee. And as ever, you can join us over on Twitter at Reverse Swept. You can also just Google Reverse Swept Radio and find the archive of the other 86 podcasts that are out there. And if ever you needed something to see you through the new year, maybe that'll do it.